Now, as we get closer to Inauguration Day, President-elect Donald Trump has released a list of nominations to key advisory positions at the federal level. News broke this week that neurosurgeon Ben Carson could take the top job at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and several generals have been offered key roles as well.
And here's one more. Scott Pruitt has been selected as the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. He is the current attorney general for the state of Oklahoma. The appointment has environmental advocates worried. Pruitt has taken a skeptical position on climate change and is currently involved in a lawsuit against the EPA in which he's worked closely with energy companies.
Steph Tai joins us now. She's an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Law, where she specializes in environmental and administrative law. Steph, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, we just heard a little bit about who Scott Pruitt is, but can you give us an overview about what his background is like and his history with environmental regulations and the EPA?
Yeah, so he's the Attorney General of Oklahoma, and in his time there, he's launched a number of lawsuits, not just the one that he mentioned, against EPA, and most of them have been on behalf of coal companies in his state. This raises, as you mentioned, a lot of concerns with environmental groups, both about his stance towards clean air protection, but also his expressed skepticism about the existence, even, of climate change. In addition, he takes a strong federalist stance, and that's sort of underlying a lot of his litigation against the government. And what that means is he takes a much more of an approach that it should be states that make their own sort of pollution determinations versus the feds.
When you say he's taken a skeptical stance of climate change, what do you mean by that? What do we know exactly what he said?
Excuse me?
Do you know exactly what he said about climate change?
Yeah. I mean, he's made statements basically saying that he doesn't really believe it's real. So that's what I mean about skepticism about its very existence. And you need to kind of believe in its existence to even actually start to address it.
Can you tell us how his track record lines up with what Donald Trump has said about his own environmental stances on the campaign trail? Are they in accordance there?
Well, some of it is definitely in accordance. Trump has said that he wants fewer regulations coming out of the government, and not just with environment, but I think he's talked about the tax code, a number of different areas. And Pruitt's track record in that sense is pretty in accordance with that. The climate change issue is a little bit trickier because Trump has said some very contradictory things about it. He's said that it's sort of he's tweeted that this is a Chinese conspiracy, but he's also said that recently that there's some connectivity maybe between human actions and climate change. So it's hard to quite know where Trump is on that.
And we know that recently Donald Trump met with Al Gore, and this was before the appointment or the selection of Pruitt. Do we know what happened at that meeting and whether there was any sort of middle ground that was found?
Yeah, that I don't know. I know that the environmental community was cautiously optimistic that maybe something would come about it, but with the appointment of Scott Pruitt, that was pretty much dash.
Now, President-elect Trump has said he'd like to cancel the Paris Accord, which is a multinational agreement that has countries involved agreeing to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. How do you think that this appointment of Scott Pruitt, what does that signal for this, the Paris Accord?
Yeah, I mean, it signals that he is committed to what he said on the campaign trail, which is that he'd try to sort of withdraw from it or at least not abide by it because of the sort of climate skepticism of Pruitt. What it actually means in terms of withdrawing from the Paris Accord, that's more something that Trump would be doing versus Pruitt. Congress hasn't ratified it, so there isn't that sort of domestic mechanism to follow it. But at the same time, it was agreed upon with a set number of parties that's needed so that if Trump were to withdraw from it, it would actually be regarded as violating international law. On the other hand, there's no real international police except for other nations. So to the extent there's any kind of international enforcement about it, it would have to be through diplomatic kind of procedures. And that would be depend on if other countries were able to bring up other agreements that Trump does want to uphold in order to sort of strong arm the U.S. to abide by the agreement.
Now, for other nations who may be looking to the United States and have in the past for leadership on issues of climate change, how does the stance that the United States seems to be taking, coming in with President-elect Trump and now the appointment of Scott Pruitt, would that signal anything to other nations about what kind of action they would be wanting to take in the future or what the United States will be asking of them?
I think it's already been signaling to other nations that there's lack of current commitment and leadership with respect to addressing climate change. There's been like a meeting pretty soon after Trump's election where a number of diplomats expressed concern about the stance of President Trump. But at the same time, it provides opportunities for other countries to take the lead. China's actually been sort of wrangling for it from the news that I've read, so it'll be interesting to see what develops.
Steph Tai is with us right now. She's associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Law, where she specializes in environmental and administrative law. And we're talking about Oklahoma State Attorney General Scott Pruitt being nominated to head the Environmental Protection Agency, which has Democrats and environmentalists worried given his skeptical stance on climate change and his involvement in a lawsuit against the EPA. We'll talk about that in a bit.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this appointment and about the prospects for environmental regulations in the upcoming Trump presidency? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. In a few, we'll continue this conversation about the future of environmental protection in the United States. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now, we're talking about news that broke this week regarding President-elect Trump's pick to head the Environmental Protection Agency.
The choice of Oklahoma State Attorney General Scott Pruitt has proven to be a controversial choice for the head of that agency. He's taken a skeptical stance on climate change and sued the EPA in the past over environmental regulations.
And we're continuing our conversation now with Steph Tai. She's an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Law School, where she specializes in environmental law. And during his time as Attorney General, Scott Pruitt coordinated with energy companies in Oklahoma. Could you tell us how closely he worked with them and what that looked like?
Yeah, the New York Times did an investigation in 2014 that found that actually some of the letters that Scott Pruitt sent to the EPA and stuff like that, asking for different approaches to the EPA's environmental rules, were actually drafted initially by the energy lobbyists themselves. So I would say pretty closely.
And is that considered unusual when it comes to attorneys general who are doing that kind of lawsuit against a federal agency?
Well, I think the landscape is changing. So these lawsuits against federal agencies coming from attorney generals have really risen. It used to be that it was primarily private groups that were raising these lawsuits themselves. And so this is actually a growing phenomenon. And to the extent it's been studied, it seems like a lot of that is coming from there's close work with these private groups. But the dynamic that has shifted is that they're raising these claims through the attorneys general versus raising the challenges themselves.
Now, in the interest of full disclosure, you've served as the lead attorney in an amicus brief on behalf of scientists who say that climate change is happening and that it has been influenced by humans. Given that, how could the appointment of Pruitt influence the ongoing conversation about climate change and how it's handled by the government?
Well, there's a lot of things that the EPA does associated with climate change. First of all, there are these regulations, especially the ones that you see that Obama has been the Obama EPA has been promulgating. So he could undergo trying to sort of remove those regulations. Now, under administrative law, the removal of regulations counts as the same thing as passing a regulation. So it needs to go through that same process of passing a regulation. So that could take some time because you can imagine that environmental groups would try to challenge that. On the other hand, he can do sort of things that are less, that take less time to do. For instance, he could simply use his prosecutorial discretion to bring fewer cases. He could pass different guidances, which have less of the effect of law, but provide agency interpretations of existing laws and regulations. And those might take a narrower stance on the prior regulation. So there's a lot of things in the regulatory and enforcement stance that he could do to do less work on climate change. The other part that's less mentioned often in the news is that the EPA actually provides millions and millions of dollars of support for universities and other groups to do research on climate change. And it's conceivable that much of that could go away.
What about President Obama's carbon emissions rules? How would that look under this particular leadership?
Yeah. So some of those rules, like I said, could go away. There's other things that are less rules in the sense that they're regulations that are passed, but other procedural approaches that are used by the Obama administration. For example, the Obama administration has used in a lot of its environmental reviews what's called the social cost of carbon, and they're using that in the sort of cost-benefit analysis of a number of things. And that could be something that would go away in the Pruitt administration of EPA.
Now, there are people who are pleased with this choice. Businessman Carl Icahn was asked in an interview with Bloomberg Politics about President-elect Trump's decision to nominate Pruitt, and we have a little bit of that conversation here.
I really think he's a great pick. I told Donald that I think he's somebody that I think will do away with many of the problems at the EPA, and they have many of them, and you know, I do believe, I can't speak for Scott, but I've spoken to him, and I think, I do think he feels pretty strongly about the absurdity of these obligations. And I feel, and I can't speak for Scott, that this should be done immediately.
That was businessman Carl Icahn there in an interview with Bloomberg Politics. And, Steph, listening to that, tell us about the people that you think would be cheering this announcement and what they may be hoping for with this appointment should it go through.
I mean, I think definitely the energy industry, in especially oil and gas or other carbon-centered kind of industries, they're going to be happy in that there's going to be less money to comply. Now, that doesn't mean that that's all of industry. Solar power, wind power, renewables, they are also part of the energy industry, and they're probably going to be less enthusiastic about a lot of this stuff. And in other industries, including real estate that's along coastal shorelines, they might be concerned with some of these effects. So I caution against looking at sort of the oil and gas industry as representing the entirety of commercial interests.
What have we heard from Democrats so far about how they may respond to this potential pick?
So I stay out of a lot of this stuff. I mean, I followed loosely in the news that they're very concerned and some people are thinking of opposing the pick. I have my skepticism about whether or not they'll be able to do so with the current composition of Congress, but, you know, we'll see what happens.
And like any governmental agency, the Environmental Protection Agency is not free of criticism. What are some of the critiques that are out there about the EPA and that may have more weight than others?
Well, we've already heard about the sort of cost of complying with regulations, although there have been empirical studies in the past that suggest that the projected cost of compliance is often actually quite less than the actual cost of compliance, because once a regulation is put in place, there's incentives to innovate and to sort of try to address those requirements as cheaply as possible. However, there are some other kinds of criticisms that I think are more legitimate, which is that some of the codes are just simply difficult to entirely abide by. There's a lot of different reporting requirements, and they sort of overlap depending on certain kinds of statuses, companies, and stuff like that. And that can lead to lack of compliance, but not really the fault of a bad actor, except for simply not knowing the full range of regulations. And so to that extent, I think there are some legitimate critiques, and having some sort of more streamlined, although, you know, still robust way of complying, I think, would be helpful.
Steph, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Steph Tighe with us there to talk about President-elect Trump's choice of Oklahoma State Attorney General Scott Pruitt to head the Environmental Protection Agency.
You can support conversations like these with your pledge right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. This is Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's the season for giving, from presents to friends and family to charitable contributions. Our next guest is hoping you'll think about making a gift that can save a life and become an organ donor.
You may have checked the box on your driver's license application that registers you as an organ donor, but what does that really mean if the time comes when your organs might be used for someone in need?
Here to shed some light on the organ donation process is Dr. Tony D'Alessandro, Medical Director of the University of Wisconsin Organ and Tissue Donation Program. He's also a transplant surgeon and a professor of surgery at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. D'Alessandro, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure to be with you this evening.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the organ and tissue donation program at the UW?
Yeah, the University of Wisconsin is one of the oldest transplant programs in the country. And this year, we actually celebrated our 50th anniversary.
Wow.
So we've been facilitating the gift of life for many years in Wisconsin and have a really strong record of donation and transplantation. But despite all of that, there are many people that still are waiting for these life-saving organs or tissue to enhance their lives. And we really, at this time of the year, really need to get that message out. In these, you know, settings, donation can be life-saving and life-altering for many, many people.
Can you talk about the kinds of waits people might have, people who are in, I imagine, desperate need of organ or tissue transplants?
That's correct. Currently, in the state of Wisconsin, there are about 2,400 people waiting for either heart, lung, liver, kidney, pancreas, even intestine in some of our pediatric recipients. In the United States, there's well over 120,000 people waiting. And every day, 22 people never get that chance at a new life, and they pass away on our waiting list. So that message about donation in our communities, locally, regionally, and nationally, really needs to get out there.
As a surgeon who would provide this life-saving service, I imagine it's got to be heartbreaking to see that happen, to know that potentially these people could be saved if the organs and tissue were out there for them.
That's so correct. We have patients who are desperate. Some patients are more ill than others and really can't wait, and sometimes that donation doesn't come in time to save their lives. And we see, I particularly see both sides. I work with the organ and tissue donation services, and so we see how selfless people are in these times when they're losing a loved one to donate. And in fact, Wisconsin has some of the highest organ donation rates in the country. And to give those families the opportunity of a legacy of their loved one living on is truly remarkable. And then to see on the other side of the transplantation, the full circle of life come around in that that person who was near death is actually living a full and productive life. And it's not just their life, it's the lives of everyone around them, their family, their friends, their husbands, wives, sisters, brothers. So there's a real ripple effect of organ donation that affects so many people.
You mentioned that Wisconsin has one of the highest rates of donation in the country. I imagine, though, it could be higher. For people listening, how can they make sure that if the time comes, that their organs and tissue can be donated?
Yes. Actually, Wisconsin has a registry. There are 3 million people in the state of Wisconsin who registered at DonateLifeWisconsin.org, where they've stated that they want to be an organ, tissue, and eye donor. And that's one of the highest rates in the country as well. Also, at the Department of Motor Vehicles, they can sign up at the DMV. The registry is your consent for donation. Whereas if you put the orange dot on, the organ and tissue donation services still has to request consent from the next of kin. The registry helps families so much when their loved one has signed up, knowing what their wishes were. Those are difficult and trying times, and so making those decisions by being on the registry is really helpful to families making that decision.
All right, let me pin this down, make sure I get it. If I have the orange dot on my wallet, there's still something more I want to do. I want to get on this registry. How do I do that?
DonateLifeWisconsin.org.
And now, I imagine, you say 3 million people, and that sounds like a big number of people, but when you need an organ for a patient, as I understand it can't just be anyone's organ. It's harder than we might think to find a match. What goes into making sure that it's the right match for the patient who needs it?
Right. There are a lot of different tests that we need to do on the donor, including blood type, including size, and we need to do additional testing to make sure that they are compatible, and particularly with organs such as kidneys, many times people who are of the same ethnic background may match better. So our community spent a lot of time in our communities with our Hispanic Americans and our African American communities to kind of say, you know, we really, and they have, those groups have higher rates of disease and on the waiting list. So we really are working with all our diverse communities to increase donation in all those segments so that more people can be matched and more people can donate. One of the things that we do, about 30% of the transplants we do are living donor, not just deceased donors. So you can donate your kidney or a part of your liver to a friend, to a loved one. And the University of Wisconsin, over the years that we've been doing this, have mastered those techniques. And many lives are saved through the selfless act of live donation as well. So it's not just deceased donation, but live donation is a way that you can help someone in need as well.
Is there something like that registry for those live donations, or is that just kind of ad hoc?
There's not a registry for live donation, but many, many of those people are on the registry as well. But when you have a loved one in need of a kidney or a liver and the waiting times are getting longer or they're not tolerating dialysis because their kidneys have failed, our program will test potential donors. And as I said, we do approximately 100 living donor kidneys each year. And overall, our total transplant program is about 400 to 450 transplants every year. But despite those numbers, there are many people still in need who can't get a transplant in time.
I imagine in the 50 years of the Wisconsin Organ and Tissue Donation Program, there have been a lot of changes, a lot of developments. Is there any research or new developments that's just coming out now that has you excited?
Oh, absolutely. University of Wisconsin has always been very innovative and at the forefront of new techniques, particularly in two areas, organ preservation. We developed a solution that the rest of the world uses to preserve organs when they're recovered, making them last longer and function better. We've also been very instrumental in developing new anti-rejection or immunosuppressive medications. And the newest project that we are currently involved in is organ preservation again, but as opposed to using cold to preserve the organs until we implant them in the recipient, we now have techniques and machines where we perfuse warm blood through them, through the organs and nutrients, and it's as though you have a live organ outside of the body. And this is a really new and exciting area. In fact, University of Wisconsin is the first transplant center in the U.S. to use that technique to preserve livers, and the initial results are very promising in terms of being able to use more livers that we can't use now and help more people in need.
Dr. D'Alessandro, as we wrap up, we mentioned at the outset, this is a season of giving. People are thinking about donations and generosity now. Do you want to leave us with a message to people around Wisconsin to get enrolled in that registry?
Right. DonateLifeWisconsin.org. Speak to your family. Speak to them in regards to their wishes about what would happen in a tragic situation. And just so that you're aware, and think of others. It doesn't have to be someone related to you. It could be a stranger. We facilitate quite a number of non-directed or humanitarian donations every year. So at this time of year, and not just this time of year, but year-round, there are people in need, and I would urge people to go to the registry and sign up at DonateLifeWisconsin.org.
Dr. D'Alessandro, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Dr. Tony D'Alessandro, medical director of the University of Wisconsin Organ and Tissue Donation Program. He's also a transplant surgeon and professor of surgery at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Been talking about organ and tissue donation in Wisconsin.